Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Rechargeable batteries are a big deal. We take them entirely for granted in our handheld devices, where they have revolutionized our access to mobile communication and information. And the next big frontier is a battery capable of reliably powering our vehicles for as many miles on a charge as we currently get from a tank of gas. Most experts are placing their bets on a lithium-ion battery to eventually do the job. And when we get there, if we get there, our national energy security woes will be all but eliminated, and we will pump vastly fewer greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, getting where we need to go. So what sort of progress has been made, and what is the holdup? Steve Levine is Washington correspondent for Quartz and Future Tense Fellow at the New America Foundation. He also teaches energy security at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service. His new book is called The Powerhouse, Inside the Invention of a Battery to Save the World. He's in town for an event tonight that hopefully the weather will allow, given by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Steve, welcome back to Think.
Glad to be back.
You make the argument here that the ultimate auto battery would literally be a global game changer. Why is it such a big deal?
That's what appealed to me to write the book in the first place, and that's the big geopolitics. So the best way to understand it is just look at what shale oil has done around the world over the last 8 or 9 months. While cutting the price of oil in half, it's caused mayhem for Vladimir Putin, for Russia. It has caused chaos in OPEC. It's made Iran much more amenable to sitting at the negotiation table with the West in order to try to strike a nuclear deal. That's the kind of impact that the potential impact that we're looking at should a super battery be invented.
Is the drop in petroleum prices right now an impediment to investment?
We have suddenly fallen into the valley of death. Yeah, that's what happened. This plunge in oil prices has handicapped the electric car makers, the battery makers. And also remember that one of the other impacts of a super battery would be to reduce your electric bills. We're also talking about the electric supply. And so they're going to have to get through this period. Some of them won't. And how long is this going to go on? Meaning low prices. The jury's out. They're going to have to hang in there. And it could be a while. It could be 3-4 years.
You have a real knack for explaining very complicated things to people like me who like simple explanations. Explain what a lithium-ion battery is and how it's maybe different from the Duracells we all grew up with, and why that particular combination of materials seems to be the focus of research for autos. Mm-hmm.
Lithium-ion is the big thing about lithium. It's the lightest metal on the periodic table. That's why scientists glommed onto it as opposed to, remember our nickel-cadmium mm-hmm. batteries and, of course, lead acid. We still have lead acid invented in 1859. We still are using those. Lithium, its sole virtue, why it is the key, is because it is so light. It means that that you can pack it into a car, into a small space, and do it at a price that people will pay. Of course, you can see we're not there yet. How does a lithium-ion battery work? Just 30-second description. So you've got two electrodes. There are three parts. There's two electrodes, and between them, a facilitator. That's called electrolyte. And all that happens is when you plug your phone into the wall, the lithium moves from one electrode to the other electrode. And when you unplug it and start talking and start using it around in your day, the lithium is moving back to the other electrode. That's it.
So why has it taken so long, given the virtues of lithium and its lightness, to get a battery that can hold enough charge to keep a car going for as long as we find it convenient and we're in the habit of driving before we, say, fill up?
Because of cost and because of the special demands of a battery in a car, the versus for our electric supply. For an electric supply, it doesn't matter what size the battery is. In a car, it has to fit into a small space. We want acceleration, right? We want to be able to put our foot on the accelerator and get around that jerk on the freeway. That means that the lithium ions are moving very fast from one electrode to the other. But we also want to be able to get from here to McKinney and back without having to recharge. That means we want the lithium ions to move slow. So you want them to move fast, but you want them to move slow. And you also don't want to catch fire in between going to McKinney and back. And so these are all challenges. And plus, you want that battery, the electric car, to cost no more than what you would pay for a combustion. Motorists, I think, would pay a little premium if they knew that over the next year or two they would save on their gas bills. But the whole idea that someone is going to figure in 5 years, 10 years, they're just not. So these are the challenges. But why can't scientists just make that battery? After all, we're doubling the performance of our silicon chips every year. We have two Voyager spacecraft that are outside the solar system. We have Hubble shooting the whole – we can see the whole universe, it seems. So what's the trouble with the battery? The battery is more than a technological device like a silicon wafer. It's like one of those old mathematical puzzles. When you hear about some mathematical problem – called by some weird name, Fermat's theorem or something, that's been sitting on the shelves since the 19th century, no one able to solve it. And then suddenly some guy in some dusty corner of Oxford University solves it. That is the battery. The battery is a 19th century, really 18th century, was invented in 1799, mathematical puzzle.
I was thinking through this research about, the invention of the incandescent light bulb, which we think of as a eureka moment, but in fact was the product of a lot of different people working on a lot of different designs, sometimes getting a little information about what the competition was doing. How much of an impediment is it that the people working on this are keeping their cards very close to the vest?
It wouldn't ordinarily be a problem. It wouldn't be a problem if it were a smaller conundrum. Mm-hmm. But since it is so very complicated, we need to be more open. We need a collaborative environment to solve this. It's a defining problem. It's a defining problem of our age because of the stakes for the United States should the invention be made here in terms of just starting with you, right, with the price you pay at the pump, the price you're paying for the electricity in your home, and then just going up the wealth of the country, creating grand new industries, and then up the scale, geopolitical issues. Our difficulties working through certain foreign policy problems with Russia, with Iran, Saudi Arabia, the Middle East, that would be much less if they didn't have so much oil money, right? And forced to be a little bit more humble about their demands and about their position. The problem needs to be attacked. It's a grand problem. It needs to be done. Just rolling back to your question, in a collaborative, that's the way, the best way. The competition is not within. The competition is without. It's with China, Japan, South Korea. That will drive people's – they will be motivated to create this breakthrough. But we need companies to stop, to stop demanding that they personally own the patent and get all the money, and the national lab system, right? They've given up. The companies have given up their industrial labs. So they depend on federally funded researchers. That system needs to be reformed in a way that allows for a more flexible intellectual property agreement with the companies.
How did you talk your way into Argonne National Laboratory, and did you have to make any promises, sign any, you know, agreements about what you would reveal in the book?
I married the director's daughter. It took a year. It took a year to negotiate. They loved the idea of producing this kind of an insider's look at what makes battery guys tick. That's the idea. So we're talking about all these grand themes, but the book is just sitting down from page one to the end of the book with scientists.
It's a lot about people, this book.
Right. It's a people story.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's a thriller. And you're there while they're trying to make this big breakthrough. And if they make it, they believe they're going to change the world. They're going to save the world. And the battery department manager, Jeff Chamberlain, tells them that every week. He sits them down and describes what's going to happen in the world if they're successful and gets them all fired up, and then they go off to the bench and do that. They were wary about the idea of having a fly on the wall. I asked for a year to sit in their total freedom. I agreed to certain restrictions. The restrictions were that I wouldn't reveal anything, any invention that they hadn't revealed through the application for a patent, through the publication of a paper, or through a presentation that someone gave. I think that was reasonable. I also agreed Argonne National Lab is a nuclear lab. While I was sitting there, I stayed for 2 years, actually. It extended to 2 years. You'd be sitting in the lunchroom, and there would be nuclear scientists at the next table talking about what they're working on. The book could only be on batteries. I could not in any manner reveal anything about anything else that went on in the lab. And, you know, finally they were in the senior management was just very cautious. And so what I did was I called the Deputy Secretary of Energy, who I know, David Sandilow. He wrote a book about batteries, 2006, electric cars, actually. And so he was already sympathetic to the topic, asked me what I needed, and I said, I need you to talk to them. He called up Argonne. Within 10 minutes, I had an email from Jeff Chamberlain. You're in. I don't know what happened, but you're in.
That must have been a good day.
It was hard to believe. So I didn't believe it. So I didn't believe it till I was actually there, walking around there without anyone following me, just free to roam and sit down and go to anyone's office. And I did that. So I teach on Tuesday evening. So I would go from Wednesdays to Friday. I would fly from Washington to Chicago Wednesdays through Fridays. And there's a Holiday Inn right at Argonne. So I'd stay there. And just drink coffee with these guys and watch them in the lab.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Steve Levine. He's Washington correspondent for Quartz and Future Tense Fellow at the New America Foundation. He's got a new book out, The Powerhouse, Inside the Invention of a Battery to Save the World. And he's in town for an appearance tonight for the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can find information on the Think page. If you've got a question, call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Summer Youth with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is now open at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist Steve Levine is in town to appear tonight before the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. He teaches energy security at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service, and he's Washington correspondent for Quartz. He has a new book out as well. It's called The Powerhouse, Inside the Invention of a Battery to Save the World, and that's what we're talking about this hour. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5732. Steve, do rock star scientists have rock star egos?
I think they do. The fellows who I was with, I think what you're asking, do rock star battery scientists rock star egos? They have egos, let's say, and that is one of the tasks for Jeff Chamberlain managing that lab. So there are only 20 certified, recognized battery geniuses in the world. Two of them are at Argonne. They invented the stuff that's in the Chevy Volt and the stuff that's going to go into Chevy's Bolt, B-O-L-T, its electric car in 2018. That's also their stuff.
The Volt is a plug-in hybrid. The Bolt will be all electric.
All electric, yes. Yeah. They try to tone down their edges, and they kind of have to because it is a government lab, and they're working in close quarters. But to create big invention, to have the belief, it's really audacity that you can make this kind of a breakthrough of the type I'm talking about. Again, when we're accustomed to Steve Jobs. He was a masterful designer. He was not an inventive genius. He was an audacious merchandiser. The belief in yourself required to break through something, a really world-class problem that you can break and keep going at it. This does take a rock star ego. So as I sat with the fellows at Argonne, I never begrudged them that. Yeah.
So what kind of progress is being made by our strongest international competition, Korea and Japan?
Yeah. Japan and Korea are our main competition because of their manufacturing genius. They are also working in the lab. They're also trying to create the super battery. That's not their strength. Their strength is taking a big risk, having the vision. We are going to own the battery space. Lithium-ion battery invented in the United States. It was decided here that it was not commercial. The Japanese Sony commercialized it in 1991. Toyota, 1996, marketed the first Prius, right? In Japan. U.S. Americans just didn't have the vision, didn't have the gumption to the conviction. This is going someplace. We're going to stick with it for a decade, however long it takes. We know it's going to be a huge industry. Japan did, and so that remains their strength and their way ahead of us. They both, Japan and South Korea, have been working on lithium-ion batteries for two decades, and they've shaved off all of the inefficiencies. They know how the machines should be configured inside the factory. All those little tricks that you only learn by doing it over and over and over and over again, year after year. And so we're missing that. We are great in the lab. This is a stereotype, but we really are. And our battery scientists, and incidentally, the battery guys, they call themselves, they're almost all foreigners. In this book, in the lab, American-born Americans don't want to invent the better battery. It's incredible. I'm going to one of the high schools right after this, and I'm going to tell these high school students, I'm speaking before 150, and I'm going to tell them that my objective is that one of them becomes a battery genius and tries to invent the super battery.
One of my favorite pieces of trivia in the book, and it really is just trivia, is that, am I right about this? The first lithium battery was invented by Exxon?
That's right. That's right. It's the precursor to the lithium-ion battery. In the 1970s, remember, we had the Arab oil embargoes, and then the nationalizations. Exxon went from pumping 8 million barrels a day of oil to pumping 2.3 because it lost its fields in the Middle East and in Venezuela. So it was an existential issue for it. And so it you know, maybe we have a future in electric cars. We're not going to make electric cars, but we'll make the battery. And then we'll figure out, you know, we'll get in with a motor company or something, and then that will be adopted by one of the car makers. So they hired away two battery geniuses, young battery geniuses at Stanford, with marching orders, invent something big. And they did. They invented the lithium battery, but it kept catching fire in the lab. It kept exploding in the lab, and the fire department kept coming and saying, hey, look, you guys got to do something here. You know, either you're – you know, you got to improve this, or, you know, you got to have your own fire department. And but then the whole politics changed. The international politics changed. Ronald Reagan came to power. He had a completely different idea about federal support for renewable energies, including batteries. And the whole thing went away. Exxon relinquished its rights over that battery again to the Japanese.
A lot of people know about Tesla being an early major player in this. Where is Tesla placing its bets with regard to the development of a really great electric car battery that might be more affordable than what exists right now?
So Tesla, Elon Musk, the CEO of Tesla, has single-handedly validated the electric car as a real thing, as not a niche phenomenon. And that's his big role. He's bet against the super battery. So he thinks that the way that his electric cars are going to become cheaper is by engineering them better, taking batteries off the shelf. He uses Panasonic batteries that look not very much different from the AA's that you buy at the supermarket. They're just a little bit bigger than those. They're called 18650s. And he puts 8,000 of those in the floorboard of his S model, this terrific sedan that he's selling right now. And he thinks that the next stage, the X, which is the SUV, which will come out, I think, later this year, and then the Model 3, he's calling that his mass market vehicle. That's meant to come out in 2018. It's meant to cost $35,000 and still go 200 miles on a single charge. His car's now just walking in without any kind of gizmos, $70,000. And as soon as you start adding stuff, they average $100,000. So that's a big jump, 100 to 35. And but again, he's engineering. He's trying to make those batteries more efficient. He's building what he calls the Gigafactory in Utah, a massive lithium-ion factory as large as all of the existing factories in the whole world. He's building one, so it'll double the global lithium-ion production. And he thinks that through all of these measures that he'll cut his price of production by 30%. So not inventing the super battery, not taming the periodic table, which is what Argon is trying to do, but working what's off the shelf right now.
Can you talk a little bit about, this is interesting to me, and I want to make sure I fully understand it. The materials that go into batteries are like, you know, small changes in them, subtle changes can have a big impact on whether something succeeds or fails. What have scientists learned about that, and what kinds of adjustments have they experimented with?
So one of the big realizations that happens in the book is that the scientists at Argon realize that everything they're doing is wrong. So they don't understand. In fact, they don't know the answer to your question. They don't know what's really going on at the atomic level in the battery. They have been tinkering. They've been using Edison's, you mentioned the incandescent light bulb. He invented that after having tried like 1,000 different ways of doing that. And so this is the way that our batteries until now have been created. But if we're going to make the super battery, it is thought, and I think that this thinking is correct, we need to really know what happens from the beginning. How are the atoms moving? When everything falls apart, where do those atoms go? And then the Argonne's thinking when they made this decision that we need to start over is that they would figure out from an atomic level what's going on, and then they would be able to create a roadmap for where to go next. So that's what they do. The things that do happen in the battery as they try to create the super battery is, so they've got their whole formulation, they've got three metals in there. It's cobalt, manganese, and nickel. And to create the super battery, they want to take the stuff that's in the volt, but they want to juice it with extra voltage. And when they juice it at the lab level, the capacity of the battery just goes through the stratosphere. It creates the super battery. But when they try to scale that up beyond the lab scale, they find out that there's chaos. When they juice that battery, when they raise the voltage, they raise it to 4.7 volts. When they do that, it causes chaos in that electrode, and it's such chaos that it becomes unusable as a battery. So that's one electrode, and I just want to say the way that I equate that, a really good way to understand that is when you drive home tonight, and you go to park in your garage. There is no garage because the garage is in the attic. And when you go through your front door, there is no front room because the front room is in the bathroom. Right? The way the battery starts out completely transmogrifies into something else. And the other thing that happens in the other electrode is it swells up four times its size. This is when silicon is used. This is thought to be one of the miracle materials, if they could put silicon in the anode, and it just it grows again. You go to your house, and suddenly your house it's occupying the whole block.
It's terrifying.
Which your neighbors wouldn't like.
Right. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Paul in Burleson. Hi, Paul.
Hello. Kind of off subject, but on subject. I was reading about thorium-powered cars that supposedly you never have to refuel them, and it's a lot less toxic or dangerous than the other isotopes that we go with in our nuclear-powered devices. And I was just wondering if these battery people are aware of this, and if they've thought about this, or if there's been any talk about that at all. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you, Paul. Thorium is thought to be one of those miracle materials for use. The article you read must have also spoken about its potential use as a replacement for uranium or plutonium in a nuclear reactor. And so I actually have not heard of thorium being suggested for a car. It's in conjunction with a nuclear reactor, and I'll have to look that up. But I do know that for the reasons that you state, it's not dangerous, and you can't use it once it's spent. You can't then turn that into a nuclear weapon, and so it's not dangerous either. You don't end up with one of these problems as we've had with Iran, as we've had with North Korea. But they're not quite there yet. It needs a lot more work. It's, again, one of those theoretical it's a theory that thorium can take this place. And let's see. Let's watch it over the coming years.
Steve, if I had a car that had a super battery in it and it could take my car 300 miles, if the lights went out in a storm, Could I plug that car battery into the house and juice up my house for a while?
Yes. In fact, this is one of the roles that some of the battery visionaries see for a symbiosis between an electric age involving cars and our electric system. Elon Musk again talks about this. So just to put to explain it in very concrete terms, Musk has a solar city. He has a solar power company where he sticks, you know, those plates on your roof. He wants to, over the next few years, and he has vowed to do this, to produce a large lithium-ion battery. And I'm showing with my hands, you know, the size
suitcase size.
And it would power your house for 2 days.
Wow.
So if you had – so you have your car. If you could hook it up, if you had, you know, the connections correct to your system, then yes, you could use your car. And again, the way that lithium-ion battery makers are seeing the future, and this again is a race because there's Japanese companies are in the lead, is that over the next 8 to 10 years, this actually comes to pass that a lot of us end up having in our house a lithium-ion battery of whatever size, and we use it, we store power in it during the low periods, right, the low peak, and then we use it to lower our electric bills during the higher peak.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Steve Levine. He's Washington correspondent for Quartz and a Future Tense Fellow at the New America Foundation. His new book is called The Powerhouse, Inside the Invention of a Battery to Save the World. He's in town for an address tonight before the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. You can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Summer Youth with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is now open at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Steve Levine of Quartz, of Future, of the New America Foundation, and of Georgetown University. His new book is called The Powerhouse, Inside the Invention of a Battery to Save the World. He is here, weather permitting, for an address tonight before the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372. We have an email here from another Steve who says, one concern I have about current electrics and hybrids is a warning that you'll have to replace the battery at great cost if you keep the car beyond, say, 5 years. Can you predict what battery costs will be in 5 or 10 years?
No, you can't predict. The GM, Tesla are both guaranteeing their batteries for 8 years. So I'm not positive, but I would think Nissan is doing the same thing. It is an issue. It's something that the car companies are going to have to address. They cost a lot, right? The battery. Well, none of the car companies will say exactly what their batteries cost, but it's between $8,000 and $15,000. So I think that the calculation is that a lot of people sell their cars before they own it for 8 years, and so that it won't be an issue when they sell the car. That person will deal with it. Or, yeah.
What do you drive?
Okay, I drive a Honda Odyssey. So there's no electric in it at all.
Do you want an electric car now or a hybrid?
I would like. So I am very thrilled by the race that's on between Elon Musk and GM to market mass market vehicles. I'm not going to spend $70,000 or $100,000 on a vehicle.
On your giant journalist and professor salary?
Well, exactly. I think that's the boat that almost all of us are in. And so, but think about it this way. So last year, the average American paid $33,000 for their new car. And that's because a lot of people are buying these big trucks. They're buying big trucks or buying big SUVs, and that drives up the average price. If it's true, if GM really does, and it unveiled its Bolt 200-mile car, $35,000, at the Detroit Auto Show a few weeks ago, Elon Musk says he's going to match that car with the Model 3. Here would be our opportunity. I would buy that car. We paid $33,000 for our car, right, for this Honda Odyssey. So what we would be doing then, when you walked into a dealer showroom, you would be able to agnostically make the decision, do I want this electric car or this combustion car? They would be comparable side by side.
How much of a hurdle for widespread adoption is the fact that if you have a hybrid or an internal combustion vehicle, and for some reason you drive more than you expected, you can find a filling station along the way and you can keep going?
Yeah. It is a big worry. That's called range anxiety. And that's why...
I love that there's a term for it.
Yeah. This is why the car companies need to have a 200-mile car, or they need to create the super battery so there's a 300-mile car. Because it's not just you getting stuck on the way, but your children, right? You lend the car to your daughter or your son. You don't want them to get stuck someplace. Think about the weather tonight, for example. And so the car companies, they need to come up with a long-range battery, and they need to come out with a system that charges faster.
So that you could pull in somewhere, pay $10 or whatever, and get your battery quickly recharged.
Right. But it's not going to be 3 minutes. It's never going to be 3 minutes. But if they could do it in between 15 and 20 minutes, I think that would be reasonable. As it is right now, a lot of people, when they go into a station, they go inside, they're buying candy bars or whatever. And that altogether takes 10 minutes, let's say. So you would be adding a little bit of time. People's habits will change.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Hal in Dallas. Hi, Hal.
Hi, Chris. I have a mundane question. What should I do with my used batteries, just AA, AAA, and other batteries?
Well, thank you so much for the question, Hal, and I'm going to expand it. Maybe you can also talk, Steve, about what happens to lithium-ion super batteries when they can no longer hold a charge. How toxic are they, and how much can be recycled?
Yeah. So lithium itself is recyclable. It's not a problem. A lot of the other ingredients, nickel, for example, inside the battery are toxic. And so this, again, is one of the issues that's raised. What happens with the old super batteries? Again, the old batteries, since we don't have a super battery yet, lithium-ion batteries. The batteries that you have, you need to dispose of properly in the dump. You know, your local dump will dispose of them properly. Don't just throw them in your
Don't put
trash.
Them in the garbage.
Yeah. So, but this is another issue about recycling, not just the lithium, but recycling the whole battery. And again, it's going to be a public opinion issue. I think I get asked this every time, so I know that people are very, very worried about the environmental side. And one upside is there are not rare earths, or there There are very, very few. There's a smattering of rare earths in an electric car.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Rex in Louisville. Hello, Rex.
Hello. I was calling, you sort of touched on it a little bit, but I was calling to ask about what work was actually being done to help improve the speed at which batteries are able to charge. I read not too long ago an article about a new kind of, I think it was an organic battery that somebody was working on for mostly cell phones and small devices that could actually achieve a full charge in really just a few minutes. And I was just curious if he had anything that he could say about that, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you, Rex. There's a lot of work being done on superchargers. It's one thing about the batteries is you don't have to have 100% charge. If you can charge up to 80%, that's usually enough to get where you want to go. And so as long as you're willing to go along with that, you can get charged up pretty fast. You can get charged up in minutes with one of these 240 watt chargers that are at some of the stations. And so however, more work needs to be done on those charging stations need to be installed all over the place. People, you know, don't want to have to go everywhere, you know, to look for where am I going to fill up. I wanted to raise one other thing because you brought up the issue of just work being done and then something that you read. One of the issues with high tech, but specifically with batteries, is you get a lot of people exaggerating what they can do and what they have done, and you get a lot of people, in fact, lying.
And even the likes of GM can be taken in.
Right. So Edison said this back in the 1920s, that there's something about the rechargeable batteries that turns inventors into liars. And this is because the stakes are so very high, because the payoff is so very big, that you get inventors promising a lot more than they can deliver. In this book, there is a point at which I discovered I had already spent these 2 years at Argonne. I had already written 3/4 of the book. I was in the home stretch, and then I got a phone call. One of the main sources on whom I had been relying had been seriously exaggerating the performance of his battery. And he took in, as Chris said, GM, the Department of Energy. He took me in. I was fooled. I was shocked. I had to rewrite the whole book. GM had to rewrite its whole game plan. It's a real shocker. But this is it. You know, this is what really happens. And it's something you, Rex, when you're reading this stuff, keep your antenna up. Stay skeptical.
Is there a chance we won't get there?
Yes, there is a chance. However, the stakes are so high, and the potential payoff so big, that it behooves us to keep trying. The economic payoff for the country, for us on an individual level, and again for our foreign policy, would be so significant that we have to stay in the game. And other countries, France, Germany, the UK, and again China, Japan, and South Korea, all of them are fully in the game. We should be too.
You know what I was thinking about reading this book was what freeways would sound like if all the vehicles driving on them were electric. Would we lose most of that noise other than tire friction?
Oh, my gosh. So one of the weekends, GM lent me a Volt so I could just experience what you're describing. And it was silence. It was incredible. And after I gave it back, I walked from my apartment to the metro, so I take the train in, and it's a 12-minute walk. And usually, I make phone calls the whole way. Right, start conducting business. I couldn't hear anything. I I I I was so used to doing this that I found that I was ignoring so much ambient sound. All of that would disappear. You know, the dump trucks, the cargo trucks, just the traffic. Let me just say that once you've done it, I suggest for those who haven't test drove an electric car, take your pick, try it.
So if American scientists win this race, how likely is it that the big lithium-ion super battery would actually be manufactured within the United States? Yeah.
This is as big of an issue as the invention of the super battery. We don't want, we should not want, a situation as what happened with the lithium-ion battery and also with the lithium, the nickel-cadmium battery, nickel metal hydride. Both of them were invented here but commercialized abroad. We want the commercialization to take place here. We have to think about that. We need engineers. We need the skillful inventors to hand off their inventors to ingenious engineers who produce an incredible product, who then hand it off to ingenious manufacturers who know how to produce it at a price that people will pay. And it's not clear that we have that right now. This is a beautiful question, and it's all part of the big picture.
And is that manufacturing? It's mostly done by robots, right? It's not like there are human jobs filling up a factory with, you know, 10,000 people carrying lunch buckets every day.
It is. They are carried out. The factories that make lithium-ion batteries in South Korea are enormous. That's a talent. That's a skill that you learn. You don't just install equipment in a big room and then start, spinning off. There are the managers, manufacturing specialists, watch what's going on, and they tweak where each piece of machinery is. All kinds of steps in the process to get the price down. We don't have that skill.
Steve Levine is Washington correspondent for Quartz and Future Tense Fellow at the New America Foundation. He also teaches energy security at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service. His new book is The Powerhouse, Inside the Invention of a Battery to Save the World. He's in town for an event tonight speaking to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Steve, it's always such a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And may your Honda Odyssey hold out until the super battery has been perfected.
Thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can send email to the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.